Hey, Larry, how's it going?
Hey, Roman, how are you doing?
Good. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
I hope you had a Merry UXmas.
It was a very Merry UXmas. I tried to do as little UX as possible in my UXmas.
Very good. What did Santa bring you?
Santa brought me a new guitar to make, so I have some materials to make that next guitar coming.
Wow. Sounds like Santa did a really good job of knowing exactly what you wanted this year.
Yeah, it's amazing how he's so perceptive of things such as that.
That's amazing. You know, Santa did a great job knowing exactly what I wanted this year, too.
And what was that?
I got a DJI Osmo mobile handheld gimbal for your iPhone.
Oh, sweet.
And, you know, one of those things that I would have never really thought to buy myself, but, you know, like come across the ad and you go, oh, wow, that's really cool. I'll get you that like smooth video and that'd be fun to play with. So I sent a kind of, you know, thoughtless text to Santa saying, hey, this would be kind of fun to have. Not really expecting that to show up under the tree, but it did, and had a lot of fun with it.
Cool. You can now make your next feature film on your iPhone.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you know, when I see a really cool gizmo like that, I'm always kind of skeptical about, like, this is a filmmaker using a prosumer tool and getting great results, but can I, the actual prosumer, you know, get good results out of your gizmo? So
right.
I kind of felt like it might be one of those sort of things where they can do amazing stuff with, you know, filming long sweeping skateboard video and snowboarding, but I can't, you know, get a family interaction. But quite the opposite, I got really cool results. We went up to the mountains for Christmas and the kids were playing in the snow, and so I got video of them sledding and it just came out really smooth and really sharp. And I got a what do they call it, a time lapse video, long shutter with the family playing Jenga. So it was like the most epic Jenga battle ever, and cut the whole thing and then compressed it down into a minute, and it looks great. It's really fun.
Wow, that sounds really good. I kind of want one of those now. I actually make sort of, you know, movies with my children. My son and I've made a couple of zombie movies together, and it would have been really nice to have a device like that at some
points
in this.
Absolutely.
Shooting. But cool. That sounds good.
I'll have to bring it out when I come out there pretty soon. Hey, speaking of being out there soon, just a little bit of housekeeping. You actually have a chance to meet both of us from UX Like Us in person very soon.
Yes, we are going to be at the UX Camp DC on Saturday. I'm frantically looking at for my calendar so I could figure out what day that is. Saturday, January 12th. It is an all-day event in Washington, D.C. It's UX Camp. It's one of those unconference camps where everybody shows up and it sort of self-organizes, and you sign up to talk about something and they sort of vote and they split up into these different rooms and everybody can just sort of interact and have these very informal talks, and it's a lot of fun. The company that we work for are sponsoring it. But we are, the both of us will also be there. And there might be, I hear rumors of there may be some stickers for UX Like Us stickers available.
Yeah, that's right. I'm working on some swag to hand out at the conference. So really excited about that. And I hope if you've been listening to the show that you'll make a point of introducing yourself. Another really good reason to go is the primary reason that we happen to be there is that the company that we work at is actually seeking candidates. So between us and undoubtedly a few other sponsors seeking talent, it'd be a good opportunity to come out and meet some people if you're considering a move this year.
Yeah. It's an awesome conference as well. So you should just come out anyway.
Right on. And maybe we'll have some stickers for you.
Maybe.
Hey, we're always trying to get people to interact on Twitter. Today, the call to action is let us know. Do you want a 2x2 inch sticker or a 3x3 inch sticker?
Yeah, because Roman texted me earlier today and asked me that, and I never answered him. So now he's going to crowdsource the information now.
That's right. Well, you know, how much real estate on the back of your MacBook is too much to ask, you know?
Yeah, that's right. I have no stickers on my MacBook.
I resisted for a long time. Yeah, it's kind of like why I don't have a tattoo, is I could never really commit to something. I never really did stickers on my MacBook for kind of the same reason. But when you get into the situation where, you know, you're working with the team consistently and everybody's computer is identical, then you start going, well, I just need to be able to not grab the wrong computer walking out of here.
There you go.
So cool. So yeah, we'll see you at DC UX Camp on January 12th in Washington, D.C.
Woohoo!
So speaking of DC UX Camp, we were at the OC UX holiday party. Again, our company was presenting there. And so speaking of the DC UX Camp, we were at the OC UX holiday party. What was it, a week, 2 weeks ago? We were also presenting there and, you know, just kind of visiting with the community. And Ryan introduced me to several people and made reference to the fact that I am the design strategist. And more than once, I got a quizzical expression on the other person's face, clearly wondering what in the world is a design strategist. And I'm embarrassed to say I didn't really actually have a good prepared answer. It's something that kind of a role I've been carving out and growing into over the last year. And still don't, you know, have a real tidy response for what I do. So I thought maybe we could chat about what is a design strategist.
Yeah. So it's not one of those things kind of like, you know, those who can't teach. It's not one of those things, right? I hope.
Right. Yeah. As I heard that one as those who can do and those who can't coach.
Right. yeah. So when I think of design strategy, it's like, let's take a step back and, you know, look at, you know, what do we talk about when we talk about design? There's like, you know, actually there's the actual doing the things that, you know, the things that we are designing. And then there's the things that we should design. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever I think of the, you know, strategist, design strategist side of things, I think, you know, maybe more on the left side of the double diamond, thinking of, you know, what are the things that we should be doing? As opposed to, you know, the actual execution of the things after we've decided what we were going to make. So it's kind of a little bit in my mind, it's working on the, you know, almost the product management side of things. It's, you know, because, you know, product management has traditionally been the side of the company that, you know, the role that is the person deciding, you know, what these are the things that we are going to build. These are the things that we're going to work on. These are the things that we are going to focus on. And it's traditionally been, based upon market data or just, you know, mm-hmm, conversations mm-hmm. with the buyer persona. But, you know, working in enterprise software, you know, we also can't just focus on the buyer persona. You also have to focus on the people that are actually using these tools that we are creating for them, and focusing on them so that they can be successful, so that their company can be successful. And so when I think of design strategies, I think of left side double diamond and what are the things that we should be working on and what we should be designing.
Yeah, I like that left side of the double diamond, particularly because it gives us a really nice sharp polygon that we can reference when we're discussing.
Looks good on a slide, you know.
Exactly. In a similar line of thinking, I see it as a design strategist is going to do three things primarily. And that's make the vision tangible. Two is connect the vision to the business strategy. And then three, craft a plan to execute the strategy. And the reason we do those three things is because it makes a nice triangle that you can put on a strategy diagram. If you wanted to do more than three things, well, you'd have to add at least two so that you can make a nice pentagon, because you don't want to end up with a square. That's like the least sexy of all the polygons.
Oh yeah, you can't have a square on a pitch deck. You know, people would be like, they'll laugh you out of the room.
Secret strategy tip number one: when faced with a square, turn it at an angle to make it a diamond.
Right.
I'm giving away all my good secrets here. Oh, that's good stuff. Yeah. So, you know, like you, I like to kind of, you know, look back at, you know, the evolution of things like this, whether it's a phrase or, a job. In this case, strategy very much comes from the military context, you know, for millennia. I read a book called On Killing by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. And in it, he cites lots of really robust studies done over centuries about military effectiveness. And this is something that militaries have done a good job of actually measuring over time. So there's like conflict between what a squad of soldiers was capable of doing, you know, efficacy wise in terms of shooting their rifles at targets versus the kill and wounding rate of what was seen on the battlefield. So through that, he makes the argument that essentially throughout most of history, the militaries have really sought to avoid fighting and killing each other to the extent possible. So that's where they came up with crazy uniforms and drums and all this stuff to try to intimidate the other army so that they never even really had to fight. So when I think about things like that, I think about how a strategist would be looking for ways to say like, oh, well, can we wear really tall hats so that we look taller than we are? And, you know, what if we all like memorized a really cool chant and, you know, yell the haka at people?
That would surely make the work environment more fun.
Right. All right, everybody, it's time for the haka. Take your shirt off. So, you know, if a military strategist would be looking for ways to increase, their efficacy through using things like the terrain or through even, you know, like psychological tricks in order to limit the amount of casualties that they'd incur and maximize the effectiveness of a military unit. Then I look at, you know, strategy then moves into like the business context, still very heavily influenced by the military context. Certainly a lot of, you know, business strategy people always cite Sun Tzu and the Art of War, right? Like, you know, as if this was you know, the right way to conduct business. And, you know, maybe within certain domains it is, but it's interesting that there's kind of a conflict between classical strategy always being through a lens of winner takes all to kind of the more modern realities where people expect businesses to behave more ethically and more socially responsibly. And so just to try to tie all that together, you know, I think of things like design strategists as being responsible for, you know, executing that that business strategy, but also considering all parties to the transaction, including things like you know, not only the customer, the consumer, the buyer, but then also looking at things like ethics, security, you know, long-term impacts, things that traditionally haven't been part of that core, you know, say, you know, business-driven mindset.
Yeah, so you're like, you know, basically talking about Facebook and how slimy they are and the fact that they didn't think about anything like that when they were doing their design work. They were just trying to maximize the amount of ad dollars that they could bring in, and they would just turn knobs and it's like, oh, this knob made more money come through this faucet. Let's turn it a little more. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Without actually thinking about what the ramifications of that could be. And especially when you're, you know, and nobody's really thought about that, just like at the scale that Facebook is mm-hmm. and the amount of people it touches and the amount of interaction it gets from, you know, the number of people across the entire world. It's hard to predict that the bad things that have happened because of that, based upon the fact that they're just, you know, tweaking knobs to bring in more money. So I think that, you know, more and more companies are looking to like, oh yeah, we also not only want to turn knobs that bring money through the faucet, but also making sure that we're not, you know, making people die or influencing elections in weird ways or allowing, you know, people to influence elections in weird ways or, you know, things like that. So I think that's mm-hmm. definitely they're hopefully the culture in Silicon Valley is changing in good ways. You know, we've also had, you know, things, you know, other companies like Uber that have had bad problems with the incentive to just maximize profits at all costs and, you know, just generally be dicks. But yeah, so I mean, so I think that's maybe kind of part of the design strategist thing is like, you know, not making sure that, you know, the business strategy is also ethical.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, and without naming any names.
I'm sorry, I named a lot of names.
I mean, ones that I actually have worked for, I should say.
Oh, okay. Good. I've not worked for any of the companies I've mentioned.
I had a former employer, and we were working on, you know, some specific issues around signups and retentions and maximizing revenue. And we were doing things that would later become known as dark patterns that were intended to essentially create friction on the way out the door, which, again, in my opinion.
Did you work at the cable company?
As a matter of fact, yes. But yeah, so, you know, certainly not doing anything classically unethical, but definitely doing our best to save the customer, as we like to call it, you know, right. with a wink and a nudge. But, you know, even in that situation where I was like discussing some of my distaste for some of the tactics that we were using to try to do this and even questioning, like, you know, are we flirting with ethical considerations here? One of my colleagues reminded me that we had an ethical obligation to maximize shareholder returns, that we, you know, as a matter of fact, as a legal fact, we were responsible for making these people as much money as we possibly could. And I remember, like, it was a radical change of perspective to me to say, like, oh, wow, so here we are, you know, in a classically ethical situation, but the new rules of the road don't consider these things. It was, I think, after that that I heard Brandon Schauer with Adaptive Path at one of their conferences, and I think he was the one who was using the phrase the triple bottom line, where it was talking about not just profit but also people and the planet. And so we're, you know, increasingly we're expecting companies to do good by, you know, all of those bottom lines, not just the profits.
Right. And I believe, I mean, and I don't know what it's called, and I'm talking way out of my range here, but there's an actual company type that you can mm-hmm. file as that is not only just profit for your shareholders, but also some sort of do-goodery clause mm-hmm. in there so that you can also, you know, not be a dick to the earth while you're being a business, or you can do, you know, other things that are like good for mankind as opposed to just mm-hmm. the shareholders and of your company. So
I believe that's a 501B, if I'm not mistaken.
Is that what it is?
I think so. Yeah. So I think it's really an interesting new domain that we're moving into, where we're trying to you know, generate design strategies that satisfy all of the parties, you know, internal and external, and not just be, you know, driven by kind of a single lens, a single point of view.
Right. And I think, like, the, you know, the very large Ben Thompson put it, the large super aggregator companies, I think I'm bringing this to light even more so because of the amount of influence and touch points that they have with the number of people and the magnitude of that across the entire world. When you make decisions that are not considering the good of mankind and the earth, then there is there's consequences to that. And I think that because, you know, their status as a super aggregator kind of magnifies the fact that, oh yeah, you kind of have to pay attention to that stuff because there are so many unintended consequences of just turning the money faucet on mm-hmm. that they didn't consider in the past. And now we're seeing that. And so that's probably a good thing, because then we can, you know, other companies can look at that as like, oh yeah, we don't want to do that. We don't, you know, we want to be, you know, a force for good. Hopefully. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I obviously that's not totally the case.
Even silly little stuff has so much more impact when you're at that scale. Yep. So when you're talking about, you know, the super aggregators, I immediately thought about that case with Twitter, where an employee on the way out either locked or disabled somehow the president's Twitter account.
Yep.
And, you know, in the normal universe, you know, and just at regular people scale, doing something like that would be considered, you know, unprofessional and whatever, you know, kind of a silly thing to do on the way out the door, but not that big of a deal, right? You can just you switch the account back on and okay, no big deal. But because it's Twitter and because of the amount of users and because it's the president and the, you know, the polarized feelings about him one way or the other, it creates this huge black eye for the company that, you know, then raises all the, you know, the Monday morning quarterbacking to say, you know, well, where were the controls that prevented this kind of thing from happening? And I just turned into a senator running an inquisition.
Where do you get to the point where you can actually push back on a business strategy because it is being unethical or there is unintended consequences that you can reveal that might happen? I mean, I bet that's probably like, imagine you're design guy at Facebook and you're like, oh my gosh, we could, you know, doing this thing will open up our platform to do all these bad things that could happen. And, you know, people in Myanmar can die, for instance, you know, if somebody could have even foreseen that happening, how do you take that to the business and say, hey, people could die if we do this thing, right? And I know that's kind of a, I don't know, it's kind of a weird situation, but you can think about, you know, if you could have even predicted that, how do you, could you actually influence the business and say, hey, we shouldn't do this because...
Yeah, I think it's everybody's responsibility in this day and age that if you have an ethical concern, that you've got to bring it up. I don't think that's ever an exception, but I think we're getting to a level of sophistication in, you know, the product design and development world to where now it merits having people kind of assigned to, you know, some of that work where you're specifically trying to look around some of those blind corners and unintended consequences. Because, you know, even if you were to say something like, you know, Facebook is a perfectly ethical organization, their ability to screw up the world just on accident is mind-boggling, right? Like, just, you know, I heard an interview where they were talking about they could do an A-B test by using the nation of New Zealand because that's like roughly, you know, whatever, we have 10% of their overall population of users. And so it was like this great little test bed and they would, you know, try out new features over there. And it's like, oh, that's all fine and good. But unless there's something that just, even if it's unintended consequences, has the ability to, like, you know, screw up.
Yeah, it seems weird that they would just pick an island like New Zealand. That's like, you know, bringing the frog from the United States and letting it go in New Zealand and totally wiping out, you know, an entire species of something that completely kills the ecology, and then the whole island dies.
yeah, exactly. So as far as like my triangle diagram goes, one of the big things that I wanted to dig into was making vision tangible. So I think a typical design job, or, you know, historically how kind of UX processes would happen. Most of the time there's going to be a vision of, you know, either some sort of a product leader or an executive or a founder who's, you know, who's really got a strong vision in their head. and, you know, in the best circumstances, is able to get that vision out to everybody. So it's all a shared vision and everybody's kind of moving in the same direction. I think where, you know, one area where designers are well suited to grow is into that realm of recognizing when the vision is not, in fact, tangible, that it's has not been well shared, and that people aren't working together towards a common goal. And in that case, certainly to help articulate that vision, but in some cases to even, you know, drive what that vision should be.
At most of the places where the product companies that I've worked at, that has been a huge problem. And I've seen it talking to, you know, the C-level saying, you know, it's like, hey, you know, I'm kind of saying, you know, it's not really clear. I don't think everybody's on the same page of, you know, what the vision is. And they're just like puzzled by this because, no, we clearly stated what the vision was at the quarterly meeting. And so everybody knows what it is, right? Because we said it at the quarterly right. meeting, and then therefore everybody is on the same page, moving in the mm-hmm. right direction. And getting them to realize that, hey, you can't just say it at the quarterly meeting. It has to be something that's articulated often. It has to be articulated in many different channels. It has to be articulated in many different ways and different manifestations of the message. Mm-hmm. It has to be done, you know, in presentation level, but also has to be like built into the, you know, objectives and key results of you know, each of the teams that are moving towards that vision. And it has to be all aligned, and that has to be visible all the way throughout the company. And so just saying what the vision is at the quarterly meeting is, it's just not enough. And I think you are correct, and you know, us as designers are really good at, you know, finding ways where we can, you know, make that vision more tangible, make it find ways to put it into the different work streams, into the, you know, the different teams, and have that shared understanding of what it is by building it into all our processes and into our objectives. and so, yeah, I think that that disconnect is of CEOs and C-level people, and hey, here's the vision, and why doesn't everybody know what the vision is a real problem.
Even if you have a vision that's clearly articulated, I've also been in situations where that vision doesn't appear to have a connection to the business strategy. So I'm thinking in terms of like where we say, you know, our vision is to, you know, be some kind of sophisticated, crazy, cutting edge technology leader. But, you know, from my seat, I'm just working on like little, you know, bug fixes or, you know, like little small short term wins. And maybe there has been a really concerted effort to say like, well, our strategy is to clean up technical debt so that we can execute against the vision. But sometimes that linkage between what the vision is and the immediate business strategy that we're following is not clear. And so I think that's yet another, you know, commonplace where, you know, the strategy just goes off the rails because, you know, the line level employee has no visibility into like, how does what I'm working on actually contribute to making that vision a reality?
Yeah, agreed. Sometimes it's really, really hard to like make that connection up. You know, especially the larger you get, you know, the larger company you're in, you know, making that connection to how I fit into that is sometimes really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. And then you also have the problem of, yeah, here's the strategy, but in my part of the company, I need to do X, Y, and Z so that I can make myself look better, and I can make, you know, I'm building little fiefdoms and being, you know, and all that stuff. And so that's sometimes very hard to, if you don't have a big solid strategy that you're continually communicating and drilling into the rest of the company, then, you know, people make up their own strategy, right?
That's exactly right.
It's like at the absence of shared understanding of what the vision is, people will get their own vision and they will march towards that. And right. So that's why, you know, that's why all this is so important. If you want to be really efficient with a company, you know, be, you know, work quickly, evolve quickly, you know, keep up with the people in the market and pull ahead of their competitors. You can't do it unless everybody's marching in the same direction. And you can't all mark in the same direction if we don't all have shared understanding what the vision are and how to get there and how my particular part fits into that entire thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So as far as the design strategist goes, I think that then, you know, there's that third piece where, again, in the absence of a plan foisted upon you, you're trying to help map out that plan of how everybody collectively is going to get there. So again, none of these things is necessarily solely the job of a designer or a design strategist. But it's the kind of areas that I think a design strategist can be very helpful and add a lot of value to.
Well, and I think it's really interesting that a lot of different thought leaders in the UX community are talking about things like this and are really business savvy in recognizing the importance of being able to, you know, make this the vision really clear and getting everybody aligned in companies on that. For example, you know, somebody like Christina Wootke, who wrote a book about how to use objectives and key results in a product company, because it's so important and it's a really good way to get everybody moving in the right direction. And you know, she comes from a UX background, and now, you know, and she just the fact that, you know, people in our industry like see these problems and it's like, hey, we can fix these problems with, you know, either through, you know, design thinking or design practices or just like really good frameworks like, you know, objectives and key results, and being able to communicate in a really interesting way how valuable they are in the book she wrote about it called Radical Focus. So books like that written by people in our industry about how to get companies, you know, moving in the right direction. That is not, you know, hey, let's what's a better way to make this button more usable? It's how do we change the culture of companies to be more effective? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So when I think about those 3 points that I brought up, those all seem to be really geared towards an internal audience. And I do think it's really important for a design strategist to also be outward facing. So talking to end users and to customers and to, you know, stakeholders of any sort. So, you know, that's an important thing to keep in mind. And, you know, as I develop my ability to articulate what a design strategist does, you know, I'll try to figure out a way to work that in there, except that that would make 4 points, which makes a square. So,
and you can't do that. You have that. So. so do you have like the 30-second elevator pitch now, or you're going to have to work on that one? So that, because you can't just talk, or you can't ramble on for 40 minutes about what a design strategy is when somebody asks you. So.
Right. I'll be like,
we just did.
I've got a podcast on that very subject.
And we talk about Facebook and we go into super aggregators and we about people dying in Myanmar. And it's great.
Exactly. I feel like it was one of those meandering Family Guy cutaways. You're like, that's design strategy.
And that is a design strategist.
Well, let me take a crack at it. I'm trying to do it cold here. So a UX strategist makes the vision tangible, connects the vision to the business strategy, and helps create a plan to execute the strategy. I don't know. I still don't feel like it encapsulates everything. Well, how about stuff designers love?
Oh, man. Stuff designers love. Do-do-do-do-do-do. Stuff designers love.
It never gets old to me.
Really? I'm really going to have to record something for that. Make a note of it. Stuff designers love jingle. So we went to a tiki bar. Nice. In Fort Wayne, in Indianapolis. So my guy I used to live with for many years and played in bands with, he's been in the restaurant business for a while, and he was like running he was GM at a restaurant. He's like run bar programs and things like that. And the last restaurant he was working at, he, you know, he's been pretty good with the owner, and they decided they're going to open a tiki bar. So now he's part owner in a tiki bar that they opened in Fountain Square in Indianapolis. And they spent like 18 months building this bar. That sounds like a really, really long time. But if you walk into the place and you see the decor there and the amount of level of detail they put into it, it's actually truly amazing. It's like the coolest like decor of a tiki bar you've ever seen in your life. They while they were going through the process of decorating it and doing it all up, they were also looking for you know, Polynesian artifacts and masks and things like that. And they somehow came across this Indiana University professor who is into paleontology and stuff, and he had a huge collection of like artifacts from Papua New Guinea, like the largest collection of artifacts from Papua New Guinea outside of a museum. And he had died recently and had an estate. And so my friend went out there to go. He was like, you know, finding pieces here and there of different places. And he found out about this. So he was like, they probably just have a couple of things, but I'll go down there anyway. Ended up having this gigantic collection of like masks and ceremonial head dresses and, you know, just all kinds of stuff. And he like called back to his business partner. He's like, we should just buy the entire estate. And so that's what they ended up doing. And so he showed me everything in the bar. He took us on a tour and everything and showed us all the stuff. And it was really, really great. But it was like really, wow. I was just like, and it's funny because like if you knew this, my friend, you would be like, this is the bar that he would have created if he had the chance. And he got to do it, which was really cool. Yeah. So it's like, it was pretty cool. It's called the Inferno Room. It's in Fountain Square in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Inferno Room.
And it is, yeah. They were like, yeah, they were like talking about that name too. And they were just like, we're really lucky because there's like no other bar in the entire United States called the Inferno Room, which is like, seems crazy.
Yeah. That's cool. Now I really want to go there. That sounds really cool.
And yeah. And so he's like, and you know, they're like very into, like, he's worked in, you know, pretty high end restaurants. So, you know, they're very into like, you know, authentic ingredients. They make all their own syrups and stuff for the tiki drinks. And they've got like, oh my God, they probably had 50 different types of rum.
Oh my goodness.
There. Yeah. Like, and they also sold bottles of rum too. I actually bought a bottle of rum from them. It's like this plantation, 8-year-old cask conditioned rum that was bottled specifically for the Inferno Room in Indianapolis. It's from some distillery in Panama or something like that. So it's pretty cool.
Sounds amazing. We'll check it out. Inferno Room in Indianapolis.
Yeah. I want to go back. I wanted to. Because like another thing about it is like they really researched like, you know, what they wanted in a tiki bar. So they like went to a bunch of different tiki bars around the country. And one of the things that really, you know, is like in any bar experience is like the standing room. Right.
Oh, my
so,
God.
You know, you've got seating at the bar, and then you've got standing room typically behind the bar. Right. And it sucks because it's like, well, you're standing there, you want to get a drink, and you have to like kind of snake yourself between two people that are already sitting down, and you have to like yell across to the bartender, and you have to like touch people and get in their way and stuff. And they were just like, we're not going to do that. Right. And so they have no standing room. It's just like a restaurant where you get a seat, you know, we seat you at the bar, you seat at a table or whatever like that. And you get seats and they do no standing room whatsoever. So you don't ever have that problem. Now, they had the issue of like people complaining because, you know, people are standing outside in line to get into this place because it's new and everybody wants to, you know, check it out and stuff. And they still do get lines on the weekends, but they're like, nope, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to have standing room because it's going to ruin the experience. It's going to ruin the ambiance. They want to have a place where people can escape, yeah. right? And be relaxed and enjoy a really amazing cocktail and good food in a really cool, interesting environment. And if you have standing room and you just let everybody in there, they could make more money, but the, you know, it would ruin the, you know, the feel and the experience of being there. Man. So I thought it was really cool that they just like, you know, they're really into that, you know, making sure the experience is good and not facilitating the things like standing room that facilitate a really bad experience at a bar.
No, it's awesome to hear about people really, you know, connected to the experience that people are going to have, because that's one of the big things that, you know, makes me hate stuff like a happy hour is anywhere you go, there's nowhere to sit. If you are lucky enough to get a seat, then you're going to have somebody's crotch in your face as they're trying to order their drink, you know, at the bar. And it's yep. just, it's the worst. So for an introvert like me, man, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was really good. If they had that bar, like within a few miles of my house, I would go there a lot.
I love the Amazon. I don't know. It's just called Amazon at Irvine. So it's not really an Amazon store. It's basically just like a designated spot to drop off and pick up stuff. And so, you know, to optimize their operations around here, Amazon in Orange County has tried to kind of scale down, I think, the number of places where they service, you know, walk in and walk out. They did a pilot program not too long ago through the Kohl's store where you could actually take returns to Kohl's and just drop them off. And I think Kohl's was looking at it as an opportunity to do a partnership. Like they gave me a big coupon. Oh, hey, thanks for using you know, Amazon returns at Kohl's, and here's a coupon for you. But they don't seem to be, or if they are still doing that, it's, you know, certain stuff has to go through certain places, you know, as far as the shipping process goes. We got both the Ninja Foodie Cooker from Santa Claus, as well as the Instant Pot from Santa Claus.
Ah, the yeah. Instant Pot.
And so, you know, I told my wife, I'm going to stay out of it. You do the research. You decide which one you want, because, you know, I'm not going to be the primary user of these things. As much as I love gadgets and as much as I love researching gadgets, day to day, it's not going to be my thing. So she did the research. She landed on the Instant Pot, and I had to take the Ninja Foodie, you know, back to Amazon. And it was a big beast of a box. It was heavy. So what I love is this storefront experience that they've come up with to facilitate pickups and returns. You walk in. The only thing missing from the experience that they've designed is an electric powered door, so that when you have your hands full, the door slides open automatically. That would have been a nice touch. But other than that, you go in and there's a place where you can print out a return label, because that was about to be a problem for me. Like my printer was out of toner, and so I didn't have the slip, and I'm like, are they gonna, you know, turn me away because I don't have the thing printed? No worries. You just walk in, you sign into a little kiosk, it prints you out your label that you needed. You can also pick up stuff. So if you want to, you know, pick stuff, you know, have stuff delivered there, you can just pick it up, kind of like a PO box. And then they had helpful staff walking around. So it was kind of like a step above the best post office I've ever been to. You know, there's a post office near me that I literally love because they're just amazing there.
Really?
I know.
That's like next thing you're going to tell me is like the DMV is right. Awesome.
I had so much fun at the DMV the other day. it's not to be believed, but there's a post office in Laguna Niguel that's just, the staff is really friendly and helpful and just to help you get stuff done. It was a lot like that at the Amazon store, but even I'd say a little bit better, because there's people actively walking around. And as soon as they saw me come in with the big box, she's like, oh, come right over here, right over here. And she showed me the counter space and she told me how to print out my thing. It was better than the airport check-in. It was better than the post office. It was a great experience.